Been doing this all day? He asks as I take a drink of water before beginning our interview. Kevin is not the most organized student. He initially neglects to have his dad sign the back of the permission slip, and when I talk to the class later, he forgets his question by the time I call on him. But when I ask him what makes his generation different, he doesn't hesitate. I feel like we don't party as much. People stay in more often. My generation lost interest in socializing in person. They don't have physical get-togethers. They just text together, and they can just stay at home. Kevin is onto something. For example, iGen teens spend less time at parties than any previous generation. The trends are similar for college students, who are asked how many hours a week they spent at parties during their senior year in high school. In 2016, they said 2 hours a week, only a third of the time Gen X students spent at parties in 1987. The decline in partying is not due to iGeners studying more, as we saw in Chapter 1. Homework time is the same or lower. The trend is also not due to immigration or changes in ethnic composition. The decline is nearly identical among white teens. Priya, the high school freshman we met in Chapter 1, says she hasn't been to any parties and doesn't want to. What you read in books is like, oh my god, high school has all these football games and parties, and when you come there, no one really does it. No one is really that interested, including me. In the SDSU freshman survey, several mentioned that the high school parties they had gone to had been adult-run affairs, not exactly the ragers memorialized in the 1980s John Hughes movies, where kids got drunk and wrecked their parents' houses. The only parties I went to in high school were birthday parties, and they were almost always supervised or included an adult somewhere, noted Nick, 18. Why are parties less popular? Kevin has an explanation for that. People party because they're bored. They want something to do. Now we have Netflix. You can watch series nonstop. There's so many things to do on the web. He might be right. With so much entertainment at home, why party? Teens also have other ways to connect and communicate, including the social media websites they spend so much time on. The party is constant, and it's on Snapchat. Just hangin'. Maybe parties aren't for this cautious, career-focused generation. Especially with the declining popularity of alcohol, perhaps iGeners are eschewing parties in favor of just hanging out with their friends. Except they're not. The number of teens who get together with their friends every day has been cut in half in just 15 years, with especially steep declines recently. This might be the most definitive evidence that iGeners spend less time interacting with their peers face-to-face than any previous generation. It's not just parties or craziness, but merely getting together with friends, spending time hanging out. That's something nearly everyone does. Nerds and jocks, introverted teens and extroverted ones, poor kids and rich kids, C students and A students, stoners and clean-cut kids. It doesn't have to involve spending money or going someplace cool. It's just being with your friends. And teens are doing it much less. The college student survey allows a more precise look at in-person social interaction, as it asks students how many hours a week they spend on those activities. College students in 2016 versus the late 1980s, spent 4 fewer hours a week socializing with their friends and 3 fewer hours a week partying. So, 7 hours a week less on in-person social interaction. That means iGeners were seeing their friends in person an hour less a day than Gen Xers and early millennials did. An hour a day less spent with friends is an hour a day less spent building social skills, negotiating relationships, and navigating emotions. Some parents might see it as an hour a day saved for more productive activities, but as we saw in the previous two chapters, the time has not been replaced with homework. It's been replaced with screen time. Teens also go out with their friends less. Chapter 1 showed the steep decline in the number of times a week teens go out without their parents. The flip side of this is those who don't go out with their friends in a typical week, the ones who are at home on Friday and Saturday night on a regular basis. That used to be a very small percentage of 12th graders, less than 8%, but by 2015, Nearly 1 out of 5 high school seniors did not go out with their friends during a typical week. The trend is even larger for 8th and 10th graders. In the 1990s, only 1 out of 5 rarely went out, but by 2015, that increased to 1 out of 3. The timing of the recent severe drop in going out and getting together with friends is highly suspicious. It occurred right when smartphones became popular and social media use really took off. Time spent with friends in person has been replaced by time spent with friends and virtual friends online. Some kids are too addicted to social media and games to interact with other people that are actually next to them, explains Kevin. They make, like, the fake online friends. Some people, like, help cheer you up online, but you don't really know them, so you can't really have a deep relationship. Let's all go together or not. If you were a teen in the 1980s or 1990s, you probably have memories of walking around the mall with your friends, checking out the gear at Sports Authority or the earrings at Claire's, and then sitting at the tables in the food court. iGeners don't do that as much either. Fewer and fewer teens are meeting their friends at the mall to hang out. That is at least one reason why so many malls across the country have closed. There's even a BuzzFeed collection of photos of abandoned malls, capturing images such as the dying plants around a mirrored escalator at the Rolling Acres Mall in Akron, Ohio, shuttered in 2013. At the former Cloverleaf Mall in Chesterfield, Virginia, a popcorn cart sits abandoned, the neon food court sign over it no longer lit. Just down the hallway, dead palm trees are bent in half around an empty fountain in the floor, with broken store displays and other debris around it. Another photo, from the Randall Park Mall in Ohio, features a circular bank of payphones. At the base, a phone book lies with its pages splayed, roadkill on the information superhighway. Observing activity after activity, iGeners are less social than millennials, Gen Xers, and boomers were at the same age. As we saw in Chapter 1, iGeners are less likely to go out or to go on dates. They are also less likely to drive around in a car just for fun, the activity at the center of teen movies of previous eras, such as Dazed and Confused and American Graffiti. A night at the movies has been a standard teen social activity for generations. What would adolescence be if it didn't involve some immature throwing of popcorn? But, as we saw in Chapter 2, iGeners are less likely to go to movies. iGen teens are less likely to go to bars and nightclubs. Even since 1988, when the drinking age was raised to 21 nationwide, the number of high school seniors who went to bars or nightclubs has been cut in half. In 2006, the New York Times documented the new trend of nightclubs for teens, called starter clubs, with some for teens under 18. By 2016, however, the Times and other newspapers noted that many dance clubs were closing. That doesn't mean teens are always staying at home having wholesome family time. 13-year-old Athena, whom we met in the introduction, told me that she and her friends are often on their phones when they are at home. "I've seen my friends with their families. They don't talk to them," she says. "They just say, okay, okay, whatever, while they're on their phones. They don't pay attention to their family." Athena has spent a lot of time by herself lately. After her summer of Netflix, texting, and social media holed up in her room, "My bed has like an imprint of my body," she says. As her summer activities illustrate, there is one activity that iGeners do more than their predecessors. They spend more leisure time alone. Although we can't say for sure, it's a good guess that this alone time is being spent online, on social media, streaming video, and texting. In short, iGen teens are less likely to take part in every single face-to-face social activity measured across 4 data sets of 3 different age groups. These fading interactions include everything from small group or one-on-one activities, such as getting together with friends, to larger group activities such as parties. They include activities with no real aim, such as cruising in a car, and those that may have more of a goal in mind, such as going to see a movie. They include activities that might be replaced by online convenience, such as going to a shopping mall, and those that can't be easily replicated online, such as going out with friends. Instead, they are communicating electronically. The conclusion is inescapable. The internet has taken over. Teens are Instagramming, Snapchatting, and texting with their friends more, and seeing them in person less. For iGeners, online friendship has replaced offline friendship. Some maintain that all of the uproar over screen time is misplaced. Teens are just connecting with their friends online, and the rest of their lives have stayed the same. This graph strongly suggests that that is not true. With the advent of social media and smartphones, teens' social lives shifted decisively away from in-person interaction. They spend much less time with their friends in person than teens in previous decades did, about an hour a day less. The lives of teens, and the rest of us, may never be the same again as mobile internet access puts down deeper and deeper roots in our lives. Others have argued that social media has not replaced in-person interaction, because the same teens who spend more time on social media also spend more time with their friends in person. However, that says more about variations among teens, the highly social, popular kids, versus the less social, nerds, than about shifts over time. It's not surprising that highly social teens are more social both on social media and in person. But on average, today's teens are spending less time with each other in person and more time online than teens did 5 years ago, fundamentally changing the lives of adolescents. If you're not an iGener, think back to high school. What do you remember the most vividly? Maybe it's the after-prom party, your first kiss, or the time you and your friends got into trouble at the mall. Chances are it's something that happened with your friends when your parents weren't around. Such experiences are less and less common for today's teens. What will they remember? That funny text exchange they had with their friend? Their best selfie? A meme that went viral? Or will they remember the few times they were actually with their friends in person? Darnell, the 20-year-old college student in Georgia, explicitly connects iGener's smartphone use with their disinclination to see people in person. The last generation always wants us to be in person, and a lot of us are not like that, he says. We're more of a technology-based generation. Without my phone, I literally would be lost. I have my calendar, I have my email, I've researched different things, I'm always reading about something. 20-year-old James, a student at the same college, says it's just easier to use social media instead of meet up in person. It's so tempting to just text someone or to just go on social media and like someone's photo and comment instead of calling and being like, hey, do you want to go out and get something to eat? That takes planning, he says. Even when they do see their friends in person, technology, especially texting, allows iGen to avoid certain social interactions. Henry, 23, likes how texting can get him out of potentially awkward social exchanges. When I arrive at a friend's house, instead of knocking on the door and coming face to face with his or her roommates or parents, I just text my friend saying, I have arrived, he says. It's easy to imagine Henry pulling over to the curb on a suburban street, sending a quick text as his phone glows, and watching his friend walk across the lawn alone. He gets in, and Henry's car speeds into the darkness, all other social interactions avoided. The screens go dark, mental health and happiness. Many people have argued that teens communicating with their friends electronically is no big deal. They're connecting with their friends, so who cares how they do it? In this view, electronic communication is just as good as in-person communication. If so, it would be just as good for mental health and happiness. Teens who communicate via social media and text should be just as happy, be just as likely to dodge loneliness, and be just as likely to avoid depression as teens who see their friends in person or engage in other activities that don't involve screens. We can find out if that's true. Let's start with happiness. The MTF surveys ask teens how happy they are in general. Very happy, pretty happy, or not very happy. And also how much time they spend on various activities during their leisure time, including both screen activities such as social networking sites, texting, and internet time, and non-screen activities, such as in-person social interaction, exercise, and print media. Thus, we can see which activities create joy and which are more likely to lead to misery. The results could not be clearer. Teens who spend more time on screen activities are more likely to be unhappy, and those who spend more time on non-screen activities are more likely to be happy. There's not a single exception. All screen activities are linked to less happiness, and all non-screen activities are linked to more happiness. For example, eighth graders who spend 10 or more hours a week on social media are 56% more likely to be unhappy than those who don't. Admittedly, 10 hours a week is a lot. So what about those who spend merely 6 hours a week or more on social media? They are still 47% more likely to say they are unhappy. But the opposite is true of in-person social interaction. Those who spend more time with their friends in person are 20% less likely to be unhappy. If you were going to give advice for a happy life based on this graph, it would be straightforward. Put down the phone, turn off the computer or iPad, and do something, anything, that does not involve a screen. These analyses can't unequivocally prove that screen time causes unhappiness. It's also possible that unhappy teens spend more time online. However, three recent studies suggest that screen time, particularly social media use, does indeed cause unhappiness. One study asked college students with Facebook pages to complete short surveys on their phones over the course of 2 weeks. They'd get a text message with a link 5 times a day and report on their mood and how much they'd used Facebook. The more they'd used Facebook, the unhappier they later felt. However, feeling unhappy did not lead to more Facebook use. Facebook use caused unhappiness, but unhappiness did not cause Facebook use. Another study of adults found the same thing. The more people used Facebook, the lower their mental health and life satisfaction at the next assessment. But after they interacted with their friends in person, their mental health and life satisfaction improved. A third study randomly assigned 1,095 Danish adults to stop using Facebook for a week, the experimental group, or to continue to use Facebook as usual, the control group. At the end of the week, those who had taken a break from Facebook were happier, less lonely, and less depressed than those who had used Facebook as usual. And by fairly substantial margins, 36% fewer were lonely, 33% fewer were depressed, and 9% more were happy. Those who stayed off Facebook were also less likely to feel sad, angry, or worried. Because the participants were randomly assigned to conditions, that rules out the explanation that people who are already unhappy, lonely, or depressed use Facebook more. As a true experiment, it shows that Facebook use causes unhappiness, loneliness, and depression. The risk of unhappiness due to social media use is the highest for the youngest teens. Eighth graders who spent 10 or more hours a week on social networking sites were 56% more likely to be unhappy, compared to 47% for 10th graders and 20% for 12th graders. As vulnerable middle schoolers, eighth graders are still developing their identities and are often struggling with body image issues. Add in cyberbullying online and it's a toxic mix. As teens get older, they are less likely to bully one another and more confident in themselves, protecting them somewhat from the slings and arrows of teen social media experience. Perhaps there are still some benefits to social media. At least in theory, social media sites are about connecting with others. Maybe using social media doesn't lead to happiness, but it might still help teens feel more included, more surrounded by friends and less alone. That's certainly what social networking sites promise. A recent commercial for Facebook Live advises, if you have more to say, take out your phone and press this Facebook icon, tap this video camera icon, and go live. Now you're not alone. Your friends are here to listen. In other words, social media can help us feel less alone and surround us with friends at every moment. If that's true, teens who spend a lot of time on social media should be less lonely, and social media should be just as good as in-person social interaction when it comes to feeling less lonely. Unfortunately for the always online iGen, that turns out not to be true. Teens who visit social networking sites every day are actually more likely to agree, I often feel lonely, I often feel left out of things, and I often wish I had more good friends. In contrast, Those who spend time with their friends in person or who play sports are less lonely. Just as for happiness, the results are clear. Screen activities are linked to more loneliness, and non-screen activities are linked to less loneliness. Teens who spend a lot of time with their friends in person are much less likely to be lonely, with their risk cut nearly in half, and those who visit social networking sites every day or nearly every day are 11% more likely to be lonely. It's non-screen activities that help teens feel less alone, not social media. The loneliest teens are those who spend more time on social media and less time with their friends in person. If social media time reduces in-person social interaction, it may lead to more loneliness through that less direct route as well. Just as with happiness, it could be that lonely teens use social media more. However, two of the studies mentioned previously both showed that social media use caused loneliness to increase. In addition, the correlation between social media use and loneliness appears across all demographic groups, boys and girls, Hispanics, whites, and blacks, and those both lower and higher in socioeconomic status. "At school, people are quieter," confides Olivia, an 18-year-old high school senior. "They are all on their technology, ignoring each other. I am dissatisfied with my life because a lot of my friends are addicted to their phones. They seem like they do not want to talk to me because they are on their phones." Olivia sounds not just lonely, but sad, even depressed. Many parents and educators are concerned that teens who are constantly on their phones might be setting themselves up for depression and other mental health issues. They worry that spending that much time in front of a screen can't possibly be healthy. We can find out if those worries are well-founded or not. MTF measures symptoms of depression with 6 items, agreeing with "life often seems meaningless," "the future often seems hopeless," "I feel that I can't do anything right," "I feel that my life is not very useful," and disagreeing with "I enjoy life as much as anyone," and "it feels good to be alive." A questionnaire like this can't diagnose clinical-level depression. That must be done by a professional using a structured interview. But it does measure classic symptoms of depression, including hopelessness, lack of meaning, and loss of interest in life. Once again, the split between screen and non-screen activities is unmistakable. Teens who spend more time on screens are more likely to be depressed, and those who spend more time on non-screen activities are less likely to be depressed. 8th graders who are heavy users of social media increase their risk of depression by 27%, while those who play sports, go to religious services, or even do homework cut their risk significantly. The teens who are the most active on social media are also those who are most in danger of developing depression, a mental health issue that devastates millions of U.S. teens each year. Younger teens are more at risk for depression connected to heavy social media use. For 10th graders, social media use carries about even odds for depression. At the very least, social networking sites do not spark joy or protect against depression the way non-screen activities do. They don't help, and especially among younger teens, actually hurt. Ben, 18, lives in Champaign, Illinois, not far from the flagship campus of the University of Illinois. When I reach him one late August morning, he's just 4 days away from beginning his freshman year at a private college in the Northeast. He's a bookworm who is happy to be heading to a place that takes academics seriously. We chat about the challenges of packing to go away to college, and then turn to the topic of social media. "I got my first Facebook page at 13, he says, the minimum age set by the site. Of course, everybody else already had one. At that age, he says, social media was a fraught experience. When I posted stuff, I was always incredibly anxious. I would sit there refreshing to make sure there were likes and stuff, he says. Now my relationship with social media is pretty different. I definitely have more self-confidence, and as a result, I sort of care less what people think of my social media. And as a result, I basically don't use it." He has hit on 3 truths about social media and teens. Their effects on mental health seem to be strongest for the youngest teens. Social media can inflame anxiety among those who are susceptible, and those who truly crave the hit of likes are often those who are the most vulnerable to mental health issues. Googling, Facebook, and depression brings up a long list of pages, including a chat board titled, "I think Facebook makes me depressed." Missing Girl, who gives her age as 16 to 17, writes, "Definitely it makes me depressed. All my friends share the fun details of their glamorous lives, and it makes me feel like, kinda hate Facebook." A poster on Reddit wrote, "Scrolling through my feed, seeing my friends being happy, makes me sad. Also because I get no messages. The sight of a message box with no notifications gives me a really sad, gut-wrenching feeling of loneliness. Facebook depresses me, so I'm going to stop using it." Depression is not just a sad mood. If it leads someone to contemplate suicide, it can be physically dangerous as well. The YRBSS, the high school survey administered by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, assesses suicide risk, measured by answering yes to at least one of the following: feeling very sad and hopeless for 2 weeks, seriously considering committing suicide, making a plan to commit suicide, or having attempted to commit suicide. Once again, the link between screen time and mental health issues is distressingly clear. Teens who spend more than 3 hours a day on electronic devices are 35% more likely to have at least one suicide risk factor. That's much more than the risk related to TV watching, suggesting that it's not just screens, but new media such as smartphones, games, and social media that are behind the link. Non-screen activities such as exercise instead lower suicide risk factors. So teens who spend a lot of time looking at their phones aren't just at higher risk of depression, they are also at an alarmingly higher risk for suicide. These analyses show that 3 hours of screen time a day increases the chance that a teen will be at risk for committing suicide. So how much screen time is too much? Risks start to increase with screen time of 2 hours or more a day and go up from there with very high levels of use, 5 or more hours, linked to considerably higher risks of suicide and unhappiness. This suggests that moderation, not necessarily a complete elimination of electronic devices from teens' lives, is the key. Why is electronic device use linked to such heightened odds of suicide risk? It's not demographics. The odds look virtually identical when gender, race, and grade are taken into account. It could be that teens at risk for suicide are drawn to electronic devices. Perhaps, but you'd think that those teens, who are often depressed, would be more drawn to passive activities such as TV, rather than interactive ones such as social media and computer games. So what specifically is so bad about electronic devices that is so much worse than TV? One factor is cyberbullying. Bullying has always been one of the biggest risk factors for suicide among teens, so it's not surprising that kids who are bullied at school are twice as likely to have at least one suicide risk factor, such as considering suicide or making a suicide plan. However, cyberbullying, electronic bullying via texting, social media, or chat rooms, is even worse. 2/3, 66% of cyberbullied teens have at least one suicide risk factor, 9% more than those who were bullied offline at school. Teens who are cyberbullied often say that there's no way to get away from their tormentors. Unlike with in-person bullies, they can't just avoid certain people. Unless they give up their phones entirely, the bullying continues. They said, "Nobody likes you, go kill yourself," 15-year-old Sierra from Virginia said in American Girls about the girls who cyberbullied her. She received one Instagram comment that read, "You have no ass, girl. Stop trying to take pictures like you have one. It's not cute. You look like a hoe. You look stupid. That outfit makes you look like a cheap prostitute that stands on the corner." The constant bullying sent Sierra into a tailspin. "I started eating ice cream all the time to not let it all get to me, but I don't want to get fat. So I just solved it by cutting," she said, referring to self-injury, which involves purposefully cutting yourself with a knife or razor blade, usually on the legs and arms. Eventually, she tried to kill herself, first by swallowing as many pills as she could find, and later by jumping in front of an oncoming car. A friend grabbed her and pulled her back. David Molak was a high school sophomore at Alamo Heights High School in San Antonio, Texas, when his classmates began relentlessly bullying him through text messages, denigrating his physical appearance, and hurling other insults. On January 4, 2016, he committed suicide. I saw the pain in David's eyes 3 nights ago as he was added to a group text only to be made fun of and kicked out 2 minutes later, his older brother Cliff wrote in a Facebook post. He stared off into the distance for what seemed like an hour. I could feel his pain. David had been enduring this sort of abuse for a very long time. In today's age, bullies don't push you into lockers. They cower behind usernames and fake profiles from miles away, constantly berating and abusing good, innocent people. Even when cyberbullying doesn't lead to suicide, it can certainly lead to unhappiness or depression. Even famous and successful iGeners are not immune. Gabby Douglas, the Olympic gymnast who won gold in the all-around competition at the 2012 Games, was cyberbullied after a disappointing performance in 2016. I wonder how many times I cried. Probably enough to fill so many gallons of water. And it would be like deep emotional cries because I was so hurt, the 21-year-old told People magazine. One set of studies by the Cyberbullying Research Center suggests that cyberbullying has become more common, with 34% of teens in 2016 affected, compared to 19% in 2007. Teens' entire lives are online, and one out of three is being bullied right where he or she lives. There's one last piece of data that indirectly but stunningly captures the move away from in-person activities and toward solo online interaction. Since 2007, the homicide rate among teens has declined, but the suicide rate has increased. The steady decline in teen homicide from 2007 to 2014 looks very similar to the decline in in-person social interaction. As teens have spent less time with one another in person, they have also become less likely to kill each other. In contrast, teen suicide rates began to tick up after 2008. The rise looks small on the graph because of the scale, but it's not. 46% more teens killed themselves in 2015 than in 2007. The rise occurred just as new media screen time started to increase and in-person social activities began to wane. In 2012, for the first time in 24 years, the teen suicide rate was higher than the teen homicide rate. The gap grew larger from 2011 to 2014, with the suicide rate 32% higher than the homicide rate by 2014. The largest gap since records have been kept. The gap remained high, 30% in 2015. The astonishing, though tentative possibility, is that the rise of the smartphone has caused both the decline in homicide and the increase in suicide. With teens spending more hours with their phones and less with their friends, more are becoming depressed and committing suicide, and fewer are committing homicide. To put it bluntly, teens have to be with each other in person to kill each other, but they can cyberbully each other into suicide through their phones. Even if bullying is not involved, screen communication can be isolating, which might lead to depression and sometimes suicide. Of course, there are many causes of depression and suicide. Too much technology is clearly not the only cause. After all, the suicide rate was even higher in the 1990s, long before smartphones existed. At the same time, it is distressing and unacceptable that so many more teens are killing themselves than did just a few years ago. Caveman brains, FOMO, and soft skills. All in all, in-person social interaction is much better for mental health than electronic communication. This makes sense. Humans are inherently social beings, and our brains evolved to crave face-to-face interaction. In hunter-gatherer times, people who got kicked out of the tribe often died because they had no one to share food with, and no one to reproduce with. Being a hermit was literally bred out of us. The legacy of this era lives in our brains, which are exquisitely attuned to social acceptance and rejection. I've studied this myself. I spent my postdoctoral fellowship researching the effects of social rejection in a series of projects led by the prominent social psychologist Roy Baumeister. We found that even a brief, randomly assigned experience of being socially rejected sent people into a tailspin, increasing aggression, creating feelings of hopelessness, and, my personal favorite, causing them to eat more cookies. Neuroscientists have found that when people are left out of a game by other players, the brain region involved in physical pain is activated. Apparently, it's not a coincidence that many terms for social pain mimic those for physical pain, including hurt feelings and heartbroken. It's more as though your brain is broken, but the term comes from ancient times when people believed that the heart was the source of our thoughts and feelings. With our brains, perhaps especially teen brains, so attuned to social rejection, texting and social media are fertile grounds for negative emotions. Even when things go well, the cadence of electronic communication can be problematic. Unlike in face-to-face interaction, electronic communication often involves a delay between your side of the conversation and your friend's reply. Think about what happens when you send a text. If the other person doesn't write back right away, you might wonder why. Is she mad? Did he not like what I said? The same happens when you post something on social media. Everyone wants to see the likes, and if they take too long to come or don't come at all, anxiety can follow. One study had college students interact in one of two ways, online or in person. Those who interacted in person felt emotionally closer to each other, which makes sense given the conditions under which our human brains evolved. Think about it this way. Humans experienced approximately 99.9% of our evolution when the only way to communicate with someone else was in person. Compared to a warm person right in front of you, electronic communication is a pale shadow. Many iGeners say that their online lives make them feel they are walking a tightrope. I find social media really stressful, actually, 19-year-old Sophia Stojic told the Australian newspaper The Age. It's just the knowledge that it's there in the background. It's very hard these days to switch it off and be with your thoughts. The other iGeners interviewed in the article all said that they try to turn off notifications or their phone entirely so they can concentrate on other things, such as talking to a friend in person. But they find they can't because they fear missing out. It's not like you can ever get away from it. You can switch off your phone, but it's still there, said Amy Bismeyer, 19. Even when time on social media goes well and makes us feel included, it is no substitute for actual face-to-face interaction. As 17-year-old Kevin says, if you have contact person-to-person, you actually get true emotions if you hang out with them. If you do something together, accomplish something together, it just feels good, you know? You get to share emotions like fighting and making up. You can't really get those kinds of feelings with social media. iGeners still yearn for in-person interaction. Nearly all of the 18- and 19-year-olds in the SDSU freshman survey said they would rather see their friends in person than communicate electronically. It is much more fun to have a conversation in person, wrote Bailey, 19. When you are actually with someone, it feels so much more personal and loving. Memories are created through experiences, and that can't happen on the phone or computer, wrote Julian, 18. For parents, teachers, student affairs professionals, and businesses, the big question is this. Will the decline in in-person social interaction lead to iGen having inferior social skills? Some preliminary evidence suggests it will. In one study, sixth graders spent 5 days at an overnight nature camp with no access to computers, cell phones, or TV. A control group continued their usual technology activities. All of the kids then took two social skills tests, naming the emotion, happy, sad, angry, fearful, expressed in a series of photos, or watching no-sound videotapes of social interactions. The kids who had spent 5 days away from screens improved their social skills significantly more than the control group did. Athena, 13, thinks that today's kids are missing out on experiences that develop their social skills. We grew up with iPhones, she says. We don't know how to communicate like normal people and look people in the eye and talk to them. Her middle school drama teacher tells students, put your phone in the box, we're learning to look people in the eye. Athena thinks that phones have affected teen speech as well. Sometimes it makes us like aliens. We don't know how to talk to people anymore. Just as playing the piano takes practice, so do social skills. iGeners are not practicing their in-person social skills as much as other generations did, So when it comes time for the recital of their social skills, they are more likely to make mistakes on stage when it matters, in college interviews, when making friends in high school, and when competing for a job. Life's social decisions are still made primarily in person, and iGen gets less experience with such situations. In the next decade, we may see more young people who know just the right emoji for a situation, but not the right facial expression. Chapter 4. Insecure, the new mental health crisis. UC Berkeley student Elof Asif was home on a break from school when it hit. Returning from a shopping trip with her mother, she felt overwhelmed with sadness and began to cry. "I pulled into the driveway, my sleeves soaked from subtly wiping away my tears," she wrote in the Daily Californian. "My mom stood there dumbfounded. She clutched my arm and asked me why I was crying, but I couldn't tell her. My unexplainable occasional sadness lingered, like my worried mother who stood by the door heartbroken, waiting for things to make sense again." Elof isn't always sure why she feels depressed, and she struggles to explain her feelings to her parents. "I don't know what's wrong, and I don't know why I feel this way, but I promise I'm fine and it will pass. That's what I tell myself when I'm walking down the street and I feel tears rolling down my face." iGeners look so happy online, making goofy faces on Snapchat and smiling in their pictures on Instagram. But dig deeper, and reality is not so comforting. iGen is on the verge of the most severe mental health crisis for young people in decades. On the surface, though, everything is fine. Everything is not awesome. You know what's awesome? Everything. Everything is awesome from the Lego Movie. The internet, and society in general, promotes a relentless positivity these days. Social media posts highlight the happy moments, but rarely the sad ones. Everyone is smiling in their selfies, unless they're doing a duck face. This positivity has its roots in a trend begun by the boomers, refined by Generation X, and brought to full force by the millennials, the growing individualism of American culture. Individualistic cultures focus more on the self and less on social rules. Individualism is behind most fundamental cultural changes of the last few decades, from trends usually considered good, the growth of equality based on race, gender, and sexual orientation, as well as those seen as more negative, the sense of entitlement displayed by so many people. Individualism also encourages people to feel good about themselves, not just as good as they should, but even better than might be justified. Positive self-views are one of the hallmarks of individualistic cultures, which encourage self-promotion and self-esteem. As the tide of individualism rose throughout the 1990s and 2000s, millennials quickly gained a reputation for overconfidence and unrealistically high expectations, one justified by their more positive self-views, higher narcissism, and heightened aspirations compared to previous generations. Those trends tapered off with iGeners, who are not the overconfident optimists millennials were at the same age. iGeners score lower in narcissism and have lower expectations, suggesting that the outsized entitlement displayed by some millennials might be on its way out. Millennial teens in the 2000s were also happier than the teens of the 1990s, the era when Gen Xers wore black t-shirts and talked about how depressed they were. With its emphasis on freedom and optimism, individualism is an advantageous system for teens, and greater happiness was the result. Then iGen arrived, and teen happiness began to falter. For 8th and 10th graders especially, the gains of the 2000s have been wiped out in the years since 2011. Just as iGen entered the samples, teen happiness started to wane from its millennial exuberance. Pop culture somehow saw this one coming, with teen movies veering from happy comedies about partying high schoolers, American Pie, Superbad, to tales of young people fighting their way through dystopian landscapes, The Hunger Games, Divergent. Of course, the happiness question is just one item, and the decline is noticeable but not extreme. So it pays to look more deeply at trends in teens' psychological well-being. The first serious rumbles of the oncoming crash in Eigener's outlook appear in their answers to questions about whether they are satisfied with themselves and with their lives as a whole. From the 1980s to the 2000s, progressively more teens said they were satisfied. Then, when the first Eigeners became high school seniors in 2012 and 2013, satisfaction suddenly plummeted, reaching all-time lows in 2015. So as teens spent less time with their friends in person and more time on their phones, their life satisfaction dropped with astonishing speed. With this sudden cataclysmic shift downward in life satisfaction, the gains of more than two decades were wiped out in just a few years. And that, as it turns out, is only the tip of the iceberg. Left out and lonely. 13-year-old Grace Nazarian opened her Instagram page one day to find pictures of her closest friends at a birthday party, one she hadn't been invited to.
"I felt like I was the only one not there," Grace told the Today Show. "I was thinking, they're having a good time without me. Then I just felt really, really bad about myself."
Grace's experience is now common. Whereas teens used to hear about social events through whispers and loose talk at school, they can now see up-to-the-minute pictures of exactly what they are missing. Eigen has a specific term for this, FOMO, fear of missing out. In many ways, it sounds like a recipe for loneliness. Of course, electronic communication can also have the opposite effect, helping teens feel connected to one another even when they are apart. Teens stay in close touch with their friends via text and online, exchanging funny Snapchat pictures and constantly updating everyone on what they're doing. But that doesn't assuage their loneliness. In fact, they are lonelier than they were just 5 years ago. A stunning 31% more 8th and 10th graders felt lonely in 2015 than in 2011, along with 22% more 12th graders. This is a monumental change in just 4 years. Teens are now lonelier than at any time since the survey began in 1991. As might be expected in the age of FOMO, teens are also more likely to say that they often feel left out. Across all three age groups, feeling left out has reached all-time highs. Like the increase in loneliness, the upswing in feeling left out has been swift and large, with many more teens experiencing this feeling of exclusion. Such large changes over a short period of time are unusual, suggesting a specific cause with a big impact. Given the timing, smartphones are the most likely culprits, increasing loneliness both directly and indirectly by replacing in-person social interaction. With teens spending less time on activities that assuage loneliness and more time on those that don't, it is not surprising that loneliness has increased. The decline in in-person social interaction is like a hitman hired by someone else. He commits the crime even though it wasn't his idea. Screen time both hires the hitman and, for good measure, fires a few shots herself. One important note, this isn't a model of how screen time and in-person time work among individual people, because teens who spend more time on social media also spend more time with their friends in person. Highly social teens are more social in both venues, and less social teens are less. It is instead a hypothesis for how these variables relate at the generational level. When teens as a group spend more time on screens and less time on in-person social interaction, loneliness will increase on average. It's possible that loneliness causes smartphone use instead of smartphone use causing loneliness, but the abrupt increase in loneliness makes this alternative much less likely. If loneliness caused smartphone use, a sudden increase in loneliness with no known cause would lead to smartphones suddenly becoming more popular. It seems much more likely that smartphones became popular, screen time increased, and thus teens' loneliness increased. And as we saw in the last chapter, several studies have shown that social media use leads to negative emotions rather than vice versa. Although the trend toward feeling left out appears among both boys and girls, the increase was especially steep among girls. 48% more girls felt left out in 2015 than in 2010, compared to a 27% increase for boys. Girls use social media more often,
giving them more opportunities to feel left out and lonely when they see their friends or classmates getting together without them. Social media are also the perfect medium for the verbal aggression favored by girls. Even before the internet, boys tended to bully one another physically and girls verbally. Social media give middle and high school girls a 24/7 platform to carry out the verbal aggression they favor, ostracizing and excluding other girls. Girls are twice as likely as boys to experience this type of electronic bullying, known as cyberbullying. In the YRBSS survey of high school students, 22% of girls said they had been cyberbullied in the last year, compared to 10% of boys. iGen teen girls are living their social lives online, and as a result, are more and more likely to feel left out. Afraid you're gonna live. Depression. In Laura's profile picture on Tumblr, she's a girl with wavy brown hair who looks no more than 16. Her site is titled, A Depressed Person Life. Her pain is starkly evident in her posts, which include, That's How Depression Hits. You wake up one morning afraid that you're gonna live. I don't know why I am so stupid. I don't know why I am so sad. And they all looked so damn happy to me. Why couldn't I look like that? The webpage's title appeared as one apt word, broken. Depression like Laura's may be more common than it used to be. Many parents and educators worry that teens' constant smartphone use, especially the constant thrum of social media and texting, has created an emotionally fragile generation prone to depression. There's been a considerable amount of debate around this question, since much of what's been discussed in the media comes from the reports of those who staff college counseling centers. These administrators say that more and more students are seeking their help and that the students' problems are more severe than they were a few years ago. However, their perceptions could be influenced by a number of outside factors, including students being more willing to seek help. To really find out whether mental health issues are more common than they once were, it would be best to have data from anonymous surveys of a representative sample of teens, all teens, not just those who seek help, preferably before they enter college, to rule out any link between college attendance and mental health, and over several decades, so we can compare their responses with those of previous generations at the same age. Fortunately, that is exactly what the MTF surveys of 8th, 10th, and 12th graders do, using the 6-item measure of depressive symptoms introduced in the last chapter. The items measure feelings and symptoms, rather than asking teens outright if they feel depressed. This helps minimize the possibility that they are more or less comfortable admitting to mental health issues. And, of course, the MTF surveys are anonymous, explicitly telling students that their responses will not be identified. This measure of depressive symptoms is not equivalent to a clinical diagnosis of major depression, but it does capture the feelings and beliefs that are major risk factors for diagnosed depression. The data from these surveys are stark. Teens' depressive symptoms have skyrocketed in a very short period of time. The number of teens who agreed, I feel like I can't do anything right, reached all-time highs in recent years, zooming upward after 2011. In all three age groups, feeling you can't do anything right also reached all-time highs in recent years. This isn't just a wave, it's a tsunami. Social media might play a role in these feelings of inadequacy. Many people post only their successes online. So many teens don't realize that their friends fail at things too. The social media profiles they see make them feel like failures. If they spent more time with their friends in person, they might realize that they are not the only ones making mistakes. One study found that college students who used Facebook more often were more depressed, but only if they felt more envy toward others. The researchers measured envy using items many social media users would agree with, such as, I generally feel inferior to others. Many of my friends have a better life than me, and many of my friends are happier than me. Megan Armstrong, a University of Missouri student who struggled with depression, put it this way. You're constantly hearing about what this person did that was really awesome. It always makes me wonder, what am I doing? What should I be doing? Is it enough? Asar, the high school senior we met in earlier chapters, is an astute observer of the patina of positivity on social media covering the ugly underbelly of reality. People post pretty Instagram posts like, my life is so great. Their lives are crap. They're teenagers, she said. They post, I'm so grateful for my bestie. That is BS. You are not so grateful for your bestie because in 2 weeks she's going to, like, cheat with your boyfriend and then y'all gonna have a bitch fight and y'all gonna, like, claw each other's ears off. That is what a teenager's life is. Azar's assessment, funny and sad at the same time, captures the paradox of iGen, an optimism and self-confidence online that covers a deep vulnerability, even depression, in real life. That's the story of iGener's life on social media, and it is increasingly the story of their generation. Like the ducks they imitate in their selfies, iGeners are calm and composed on the surface, but paddling madly underneath. It goes beyond just feeling inadequate, however. More teens in recent years agree with the depressing statement, my life is not useful, with feelings of uselessness reaching all-time highs. In addition, fewer teens agree that I enjoy life as much as anyone. Disagreeing with this item is a clear symptom of depression, as depressed people nearly always say that they no longer enjoy life as much as they used to. In just the few years between 2012 and 2015, more and more teens said they don't enjoy life. Across all six items, depression has skyrocketed in just a few years, a trend that appears among blacks, whites, and Hispanics in all regions of the United States, across socioeconomic classes, and in small towns, suburbs, and big cities. On Tumblr, a microblogging site popular with teens, mentions of mental health increased 248% between 2013 and 2016. If you wanted to create an environment to churn out really angsty people, we've done it, said Janice Whitlock, a Cornell University researcher. They're in a cauldron of stimulus they can't get away from. Just as with the rise in loneliness, girls have borne the brunt of the rise in depressive symptoms. Although teen girls and boys were once about equally likely to experience the symptoms of depression, girls now report markedly higher levels. Boys' depression increased by 21% between 2012 and 2015, and girls increased by 50%, more than twice as much. And girls spend more time on social media than boys do. We're the first generation that cannot escape our problems at all, 20-year-old Faith Ann Bishop told Time. College students' mental health is also deteriorating. In a major overtime survey administered by the American Collegiate Health Association, college students are now more likely to say they feel overwhelming anxiety and that they felt so depressed they could not function. Just as with high school students, anxiety and depression ticked up recently, just since 2013. The American Freshman Survey of Entering College Students shows similar trends. Every indicator of mental health issues on the survey reached all-time highs in 2016, rating emotional health below average, increasing 18% since 2009, feeling overwhelmed, increasing 51%, expecting to seek counseling, increasing 64%, and, perhaps most troubling, feeling depressed, increasing 95% or nearly doubling, with noticeable jumps just between 2015 and 2016. In 2016, for the first time, the majority of entering college students described their mental health as below average. Overall, more and more college students are struggling with mental health issues, not just those who seek help at counseling centers, but among representative samples completing anonymous surveys. The sudden sharp rise in depressive symptoms occurred at almost exactly the same time that smartphones became ubiquitous and in-person interaction plummeted. That seems like too much of a coincidence for the trends not to be connected, especially because spending more time on social media and less time on in-person social interaction is correlated with depression. With correlation data like this, social media could cause depression, depressed people could use social media more, or a third factor could explain the rise in both. Even if the second two explanations are true for individual people, they don't work very well for explaining why depression would increase so suddenly. That leaves the possibility of some unknown outside factor that suddenly caused more depression among teens. Could the Great Recession of 2007 to 2009 be the outside factor? It did come on suddenly, but the timing is wrong. Unemployment, one of the best indicators of how the economy is affecting real people, peaked in 2010 and then declined, exactly the opposite pattern from depression, which was stable until 2012 and then increased. Smartphones, however, gained in popularity over that same time. Why might smartphones cause depression? For one thing, not getting a reply to your text or social media message has a high potential for causing anxiety, a common precursor to depression. An exchange among three 16-year-old girls in Los Angeles captured this in American Girls. "I mean, we all, like, overanalyze it," said Greta, referring to boys who don't respond to texts or Snapchats. "It goes both ways. I love it that, like, if I'm mad at a boy, he can see that I've seen his message and he knows that I'm ignoring him. It causes stress, though, when it's you," said Melissa. "And depression," said Padma. "When they ignore your texts and then you're like, well, why am I even alive?" Girls may also be uniquely vulnerable to the effects of social media on mental health. The emphasis on perfect selfies has amplified body image issues for girls, who often chase likes by taking hundreds of pictures to get just the right one, but still end up feeling as though they've fallen short. They make you think you have to change yourself, like lose weight or gain weight, instead of just being yourself, said a 16-year-old in American Girls. "Every day, it's like you have to wake up and put on a mask and try to be somebody else instead of being yourself," said another. "And you can't ever be happy." 19-year-old Asena O'Neill, a model who made her living by posting her photos on Instagram, suddenly took down her social media accounts in November 2015. She posted a YouTube video in which she said, "I spent hours watching perfect girls online, wishing I was them. Then, when I was one of them, I still wasn't happy, content, or at peace with myself. Social media is not real life." Her photos, which looked like casual snaps, actually took several hours to set up and up to 100 attempts to get right. Caring about her number of followers, she said, "suffocated me. I was miserable." Double standards of sexuality are also very evident online. Girls often feel that they can't win. A sexy photo will get lots of likes, but it also invites slut-shaming. The usual girl drama of who said what to whom and who has a crush on whom is also heightened on social media, surrounding girls 24 hours a day with the back and forth of an often toxic interaction, all without the context of facial expressions and gestures. The perennial teen girl question, "Is she mad at me?" is much harder to answer on a smartphone. An epidemic of anguish, major depressive disorder, self-harm, and suicide. Madison Hollerin was everything most young girls want to grow up to be: beautiful, academically successful, athletic. She was raised in New Jersey, one of five siblings in a close-knit family, and headed off to college at the University of Pennsylvania, where she ran track. Like many college students, she posted pictures on her Instagram page: track meets, friends, parties. "Madison, you look like you're so happy at this party," her mother told her. "Mom," Madison replied, "it's just a picture." Madison's Instagram account didn't capture what was really going on. She was depressed. She was, she confided to her friend Emma, scared to grow up, terrified that she didn't know exactly what would happen next. She had yet to get a driver's license. After a tough first semester at Penn, she started seeing a therapist near her home in New Jersey. One day in January of her freshman year, her father called and asked if she had found a therapist in Philadelphia so she could continue her treatment when she was at school. "No, but don't worry, Daddy, I'll find one," she said. A few hours later, she jumped off the roof of a 9-story parking garage to her death. She was 19 years old. So far, what we've discussed is variations in symptoms among the normal population. Worrisome signs, but not evidence of clinical-level depression. Those feelings are still very important, as they affect large numbers of teens and are risk factors for more serious issues. Yet most of the time, they don't rise to the level of a debilitating mental illness. So, it's fair to ask, has the rise in feelings of loneliness, depression, and anxiety also been accompanied by changes in diagnosable depression and its most extreme outcome, suicide? The National Survey on Drug Use and Health, NSDUH, conducted by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, has screened U.S. teens for clinical-level depression since 2004. The project sends trained interviewers to assess a nationally representative sample of more than 17,000 teens, ages 12 to 17, across the country every year. Participants hear questions through headphones and enter their answers directly into a laptop computer, ensuring privacy and confidentiality. The questions rely on the criteria for major depressive disorder documented in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, DSM, of the American Psychiatric Association, the gold standard for diagnosing mental health issues. The criteria include experiencing depressed mood, insomnia, fatigue, or markedly diminished pleasure in life every day for at least 2 weeks. The study is specifically designed to prove a benchmark for rates of mental illness among Americans, regardless of whether they've ever sought treatment. A study like this is about as reliable and valid as you can get. The screening test shows a shocking rise in depression in a short period of time. 56% more teens experienced a major depressive episode in 2015 than in 2010, and 60% more experienced